Welcome to PCS Caregiving, where we discuss a variety of caregiver issues and how helping professionals can better serve military families as they PCS from their role as a spouse, friend, partner, or loved one to a caregiver. I'm your host, Rachel Browner. Join us each episode as we feature unique caregiver issues, tips, strategies, resources, and subject matter experts on this PCS caregiving journey. For those of our listeners that are not familiar with the military acronym PCS, it stands for Permanent Change of Station, and the term is commonly used in the military as service members and families transition to different duty stations. But we're using it in the context that can be useful in describing the transition military caregivers experience as they care for wounded warriors or individuals with special health care needs. Did you know that 50% of a person's health status can be attributed to behavioral factors such as diet, physical activity, and sleep, among others? In today's podcast, Andy Crocker, Extension Program Specialist in Gerontology and Health at Texas A&M AgriLife Extension Service, will discuss basic tips and strategies to improve our health and wellness and explore factors that affect health with a focus on lifestyle choices and provider resources to try to start making healthy the easy choice.
When we talk about health and well-being, it can often be overwhelming to think about what goes into that, because sometimes we assume that being healthy or being well means that we don't have a disease, we don't have an illness. But the reality is that we can live healthy, well lifestyles even if we have a chronic condition such as diabetes or hypertension. It's how we manage it. It's how we let that disease process affect us. And so we're going to talk today about what goes into well-being and some of the things that we can do to help maximize our ability to incorporate that into our lifestyle, but then also reduce the impact that a chronic condition has on us and on our condition. So let's start by talking about some of the things that are common that we see in the population. You know, we see a lot of heart disease, a lot of cancer, diabetes, arthritis. These are all chronic conditions, and they may occur with varying degree, but they're pretty prevalent through the population. And what we know about chronic conditions, in addition to the fact that they stick around for a long time and they affect a lot of people, is they're expensive. It's expensive to manage, and especially if management doesn't go well. So for instance, let's say I've got diabetes, but I'm not necessarily compliant with diet and exercise recommendations, and I have to buy more and more medication to keep my diabetes in check, that can get very expensive, to the tune of, you know, if someone has one chronic condition, their health expenditures may be twice as high as an American without that chronic condition. And if they have five or more chronic conditions, their health expenditures can be up to 14 times as higher. So in addition to maintaining health, chronic conditions keeping chronic conditions in check can actually help impact our pocketbook. The thing to understand about this is it's all interrelated. You know, we often think about our health status as something that we don't have a whole lot of control over, that it's baked into our genetics, or it's part of our environment, or it has to do with the moon and the stars. But really, it's a variety of factors that includes genetics, that includes environment. A big source of our health status comes from our health behaviors, like choices we make, things over which we have some modicum of control. And then we can also talk about access and then social and societal pressures that all go into creating a picture of health for the average American. And I say average American because what we're going to talk about today is kind of a portrait of health that the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has put together based on longitudinal studies. And they're called longitudinal studies because they go over a long period of time. So they'll follow generations of people, and they're a couple of big ones, the NHANES study, the Framingham study. Some of these have been going on since the 30s, looking at a person and then looking at that person's offspring and then looking at that person's offspring just to kind of see what happens in people, how it happens, the frequency, what they can do about it, et cetera. And from this, we get this kind of 30,000 foot view of what health looks like in America. The Robert Wood Johnson Foundation has kind of coined a term that says your zip code may be important than your genetic code when evaluating your health and wellness, which is interesting to think about because we don't often think about social and societal pressures impacting our health and wellness, but it does play a big role. And the World Health Organization defines this as the conditions in which people are born, grow, work, live, and age, and the wider set of forces and systems that shape their day-to-day life. And so if you think about this for a moment, it kind of makes sense. You know, does your neighborhood have sidewalks? Can you go outside and go for a walk to get physical activity? How many convenience stores do you pass before you get to a grocery store where you can buy fresh fruits and vegetables? And if we think about health in a broader context, how many payday loan places do you pass before you can get to a bank? So our social pressures, the area that we're living in and working in and playing in and all of these other things really do affect us. In a pretty amazing look at the influences in our neighborhood, a study found that stray dogs contributed to the increase in diabetes in a community. And you may be thinking to yourself, well, that doesn't make any sense. What does a stray dog have to do with rising diabetes in the community? Well, people were scared to walk because all of these feral dogs were out in their community and they were afraid of being attacked by those dogs when they went out to try to get physical activity. So, you know, that's an example where, you know, seemingly a couple of really unrelated things can, you know, combine to make us less healthy if we're not able to get out into our social surroundings, our societal surroundings, and do what we need to do to be healthier people. So pairing with social and societal is the idea of access. Access is the ability to get the information and services that we need. And so we've already talked a little bit about being able to access fresh fruits and vegetables, whole grains, things like that at a local grocer, or you know, being able to access the bank so that I can do my business without paying exorbitant fees to cash a check or to get the money that I need in order to buy another service. Access could also be, you know, can I get in to see my health provider for preventive maintenance or in a response to a health crisis that I'm having? Do I have access to benefits that let me go do that? Access can also be something like I'm standing in the aisle of the grocery store and I'm trying to pick out a pain reliever, but I need to know the difference between aspirin and acetaminophen and ibuprofen and naproxen. You know, which one did the doctor say would upset my stomach? Which one did the doctor say that I shouldn't take because it might interfere with my blood thinner? And so access even involves being able to get and understand information that I need to make health decisions for myself. And access ends up being a big part of our health status, something like 10% of our health status. And we don't always think about information and resources and services making that big of a difference in our life, but it really does. And then because things are interconnected, something like a grocery store or a bank or a community resource like the United Way or the Area Agency on Aging something that we need to take advantage of a service that they offer really does play a role in our lives. So what I encourage you to do is to look around and see what is available in your community, in your kind of nuclear network, you know, whatever you define your community is. Is it your block? Is it your neighborhood? Is it your zip code? You know, look around and see what's there. And then the other thing is, take advantage of those services, because part of access is, wait for it, accessing these services, not just knowing that they're there, but taking advantage of them. Call people up and say, hi, what services do you provide? Do you charge for them? How do I qualify? What can I do to benefit from this service? Because it really does make a difference in your health and well-being to be able to access resources and services in your community. Your environment also plays a big role in your health status. And we've already talked about kind of your external environment, your neighborhood, the grocery store, the bank, the stray dogs roaming your community that may keep you from accomplishing physical activity. So let's talk about your home environment, the four walls and the roof under which you live. That can really play a role in your health and well-being, mainly, you know, indoor air quality. We need to make sure that we're keeping our house controlling moisture. It's funny, I grew up in a place where we ran a dehumidifier in our home to pull water out of the air. I grew up in Louisiana, and it was my job to empty the dehumidifier. And it was always amazing, you know, how much water could be collected in just a couple of days, pulling it out of the air just to keep the moisture level in the house such that all the envelopes didn't seal themselves because they were so damp. And now I live in a place where we have a humidifier that runs in our home almost all the time. It's even hooked into the central air and heat because it's such a dry climate that we need that added moisture. So control the moisture in your home, whatever that means, for the area in which you live, because, you know, it's good for our skin, it's good for our lungs, it's good for our mucous membranes, it's good for our surroundings. It can help control dust and other things. So, but watch it, because, you know, like all things in life, some is good, more is not better. So we don't want a super humid environment, because otherwise you'll end up with a bunch of sealed envelopes around your home. Try to keep it clean and keep it ventilated, so that you've got fresh air in there at different times. And then also, you know, we're controlling for dust and other things that may impact our environment. Keep it free of combustion byproducts. So this is stuff like smoke, secondhand smoke, carbon monoxide. Keep it pest-free, keep it free of chemicals, and try to keep it comfortable. So, you know, we need a relatively cool existence. And so, you know, it is important to have that air conditioning going in your home, so that, you know, you've got a cool place where you can sleep well and where, you know, you can relax and you're not always sweaty and on edge and things like that, because it's not cool enough in your home. Also, for older adults specifically, we've got to be careful about falling around the home. We know that falls are a significant risk factor, or older adults are at a significant risk for falling. And most falls occur around the home because that's where we're most comfortable, and that's where we're most likely to take risks that maybe wouldn't otherwise. So I talk to a lot of people who say, well, I don't need to wear my glasses around the house, or I don't need to turn the lights on around the house. Well, if you need your glasses everywhere else, you need your glasses when you're at the house. If you need an assistive device like a cane or a walker out in public, then you need it at your house. Don't let the familiarity and the comfort of your home lead you to take risks that you wouldn't take otherwise just because you feel comfortable there. So be very careful about that, and look for ways that you can change your home environment. If some of the things that I just talked to you about say, you know, ring a bell with you, this is where it goes back to access. Call around and see what services might be available in your area to help you with your home environment. You know, so maybe you can't have a whole home humidifier, but can you go to the local big box store and get a humidifier that sits in your room to help with indoor air quality? Or, you know, if insulation and things like that is a problem in your home, is there a local resource or service that you can tap that may be able to come in and do limited home modifications, you know? So access those services. How do I qualify? What do you charge? Things like that, to see what may be available to you, because, you know, if you're doing environment and access, then you're making a big mark on your health and wellness.
Andy, something we all think about but don't really think that we can make an impact on is our genetics. Can you talk to our listeners about how genes play a role in health and wellness?
Our genes do play a role in our health and wellness. And while I can't change my genes, I can probably change, or I can try to change how they affect me. So in my family, hypertension and high cholesterol kind of runs in my family. My grandfather has it, my grandmother has it, my dad has it, my mom has it. And so you know, genetics would say that I probably am at risk for cardiovascular issues due to high cholesterol and hypertension. But because I know this, I can get physical activity, I can watch what I eat, I can work with my health provider to be on the lookout for these conditions that may, and I want to emphasize may here, may impact me at some point in my life. And so the reason that I'm able to have this conversation with my health provider, get physical activity, watch what I eat, is because I know my family's health history. So the biggest thing that we can do to impact our genetics is to know our family's health history and then try to be responsive to that. So, you know, if you know that breast cancer, say, runs in your family, then, you know, that can be instructive for you and for your health provider to be super diligent about watching for early indicators of breast cancer. If diabetes runs in your family, then that can be instructive to you for physical activity and nutrition, and then working with your health provider to know that you may be at an increased risk for this because it runs in your family. So what I encourage you to do to address the genetic risks that play a role in your health and wellness is to know and write your family's health history. And the Surgeon General has a great tool that's available through the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention that can help you write your family's health history. November is actually designated as Family Health History Month. And so the idea is that while you and your family are all gathered around, you know, celebrating the holiday season, that it's a good time to talk about what conditions run in your family, you know, what conditions have affected people before. And then that starts a running list that then can be passed down to other people. And a lot of older adults say, oh, well, you know, I'm old and I don't need to do this and that kind of thing. But you're not necessarily doing it for yourself, even though arguably you are, because if you change health providers, the first thing he or she is going to want to know is, what's your family's health history? But you're doing it for your kids and your grandkids and generations of people that will come behind you that never knew you existed other than they know their family's health history. So do take this part seriously. Genetics does play a role, and no, we can't change our genes, but we can try to change how we're affected by genetic predisposition to certain things. So the big thing with our health and wellness is lifestyle choices, things over which we have some modicum of control. And I say big things because some studies estimate that this impacts our health status to the tune of 50%. So, you know, half of our health status is theoretically determined by things over which we have some control. So the big four things are tobacco cessation, getting physical activity, eating well, and using alcohol in moderation. And, you know, if we could stop using tobacco, get physical activity, and eat properly, we could knock out the top three causes of death in the United States. Now, that doesn't mean that people wouldn't die anymore. I mean, people are always going to die, but they would die from, you know, random one-offs, like getting run over by a zebra or something. So tobacco cessation, physical activity, and eating well. Tobacco cessation, both smoke and smokeless. A lot of times we're a little blasé about tobacco cessation because we think, oh, we'll just quit. But it is an addiction and it is a lot of work. But this is where pairing some of the things can come into play. So I've made a commitment to myself and my family that I'm going to improve our home environment, which we already know is important for well-being. And so I'm not going to smoke in the home. Well, that's a step in the right direction. You know, that's going from step one to step two in my journey to quit using tobacco. And then because I know that access is also important, I see the billboards all over town that say, call this number, we'll help you quit. And so I'm going to access that service that's available to me. So in that way, you know, between making that lifestyle choice, improving our environmental air quality, and then also accessing the service, I've done a really great thing for me and for my family with taking just those steps. A lot of times people don't realize that their health benefit may provide some opportunity for tobacco cessation. So again, with older adults specifically, Medicare Part B, B as in boy, does pay for some tobacco cessation activities. So make the choice for yourself. give yourself a little bit of a break, knowing that it's an addiction and it's going to take a while, and then access the services to which you're entitled or that may be available to you. And then know that by doing this, you're also improving your environment. You've really kind of taken a huge step toward a healthier lifestyle in that way. Physical activity is 30 minutes a day, most days of the week. I'll say it again, 30 minutes a day, most days of the week, not 12 hours a day, 12 days a week, 30 minutes a day, most days of the week. And think about physical activity as more than just exercise, because it is. You know, a lot of times people think exercise involves having to go to the gym and I need special equipment or I need special outfit. But really, physical activity could be something as simple as picking up sticks in the yard or running the vacuum in the house. Or when I go to the store, I park at the far end of the parking lot and I walk across the parking lot kind of at a faster clip to get my heart rate up a little bit. But find an opportunity to get your heart rate up 30 minutes a day, most days of the week. And if you don't have 30 minutes that you can devote to this in a 24-hour period, you can break it up into 10-minute chunks, and the differences are negligible. So do yourself a favor and get up and get moving at least 30 minutes a day, most days of the week. With nutrition, we want to vary our diets with lean meats, fish, fruits, vegetables, whole grains, and low-fat dairy. A lot of times our nutrition, you know, comes down to portion sizes, frankly. Some combination that Americans eat an unhealthy diet, kind of, but some of it is just that we eat too much. And then when we pair that with the fact that we don't get enough physical activity, we do ourselves a disservice. You often hear nutrition talked about in terms of energy balance, balancing the energy that we take in versus the energy that we put out. And if we think about food as fuel, we don't need to give our body more fuel than it needs. So if I have a pretty sedentary lifestyle, I don't have the same fueling needs as somebody who runs a marathon, you know, once a month or however often you run a marathon, I don't know. But we need to vary our diets, but we also need to be careful about not getting our bodies too much energy. And so use something like choosemyplate.gov's menu finder, where, you know, you put in your age and your sex and your activity level, and it kind of tells you what your nutrient needs are. It has recipes and recommended menu plans and things like that to find ways to vary our diets with lean meats, fruits, vegetables, whole grains, and low-fat dairy. And half of our plate, 50%, half of our plate at each meal should be fruits and vegetables. That's hard to do, especially, you know, in the winter when fresh fruits and vegetables may not be as abundant, but are frozen fruits and vegetables available to you? What can you do to continue to incorporate fruits and vegetables into your diet every day to the tune of half of your plate? In nutrition, we also don't want to forget about hydration, because fluids are very important. Most of our body is fluid. And so water, of course, decaffeinated coffees and teas, 100% fruit juices, low-fat dairy, these are all things that can help with hydration. And we need to be diligent about that. Basic recommendations are 8 8-ounce glasses of some kind of fluid per day. So that's 64 ounces of some fluid per day. If you're a more active person, you may need more than that. If you're a less active person, you may need less than that, but that's kind of a good target. But don't discount the role that fluid plays in your diet. Also, moderate alcohol use. So current recommendations are 2 drinks a day for a man and 1 drink a day for a woman. And it's important to understand that there are equivalencies here. So 1 to 2 ounces of hard liquor equals 4 to 6 ounces of wine equals 12 ounces of beer. So, you know, don't be like me, frankly, sometimes, where I think I've done better for myself because I had a beer rather than a margarita, when in fact, they're basically equivalent. And in reality, some of the beers that I enjoy from time to time may have higher alcohol content than that margarita. So be very careful about that and be sure to limit alcohol. And then also know that if we're enjoying a beverage, we probably need to up our other fluid intake to compensate for that. Just like if I enjoy a lot of coffee, I need to up my fluid intake otherwise to replace those lost fluids that I'm losing due to the alcohol or the caffeine having a diuretic effect.
Thank you, Andy, for identifying factors that impact our health and simple strategies for us to use in making positive lifestyle choices for our overall health and well-being. Make sure to tune in next month as we continue our conversation on lifestyle choices and how healthy sleeping habits can be one of the most rewarding choices you can make for your health.
Support for the Military Families Learning Network is from the National Institute of Food and Agriculture, U.S. Department of Agriculture, and the Office of Military Family Readiness Policy, U.S. Department of Defense.